during the break, actually, collected a number of announcements. Now, the majority of these we shall leave until later, but there was one that we must make now. And that is, could anybody who will not be stopping for lunch please raise a hand? Anybody who will not be stopping. Thank you very much. And so then now, my dear brethren and sisters, we shall continue. Our subject title now is The Confederacy of Gog. And we now look to our brother Philip Taylor of the Colchester Ecclesia to speak to us upon that subject. The Confederacy of Gog.
When we read the writings of our brother Thomas, brethren and sisters, on the subject of prophecy, we sometimes find that he was even more right, if that's possible, than he could himself have realised. In 120 years since our brother fell asleep, events have turned out which reveal that some of these symbols are even more appropriate to the interpretation which he put upon them than he himself would have known. And we believe that we shall see an example of this as we proceed. But before we look in detail at the Gog and Confederacy, we wish first of all to emphasise a point which Brother David made concerning the timing of its fulfilment. And this, we believe, is very important because there are currently at least three, probably more, but at least three erroneous views taught in the Brotherhood. One of these is that this is the same as the reference to Gog and Magog in the Book of the Apocalypse, chapter 20. Well, if this is so, then either Ezekiel 38 is not fulfilled until the end of the millennium, or Revelation 20 is fulfilled at the beginning of the millennium. And some very ingenious mental gymnastics are required to make either of those ideas fit. Now, the other two erroneous views to which we would refer are quite different from one another in their conclusion, but they are based upon a common false premise. And that false premise is that when Christ returns to the earth, he descends directly from heaven onto the Mount of Olives, and the first thing which he does is go to the defence of Jerusalem. If that is so, then that means that the judgment of the household cannot take place until after Jesus is enthroned in Zion. And from this false premise, two opposing views arise. The first is that it is indeed the Gogian host which is then defeated by Christ, although without the involvement of the saints, and that the Confederacy, which is referred to, which we will look at in detail, is prepared in its entirety before Jesus returns to the earth. And the other erroneous view is that it isn't the Gogian host that Christ defeats when he first returns to the earth, but the Arab powers, and then, as Brother David referred to, Gog attacks Jerusalem after Jesus is enthroned upon Mount Zion. Now, the scriptures make it very plain that the first thing which Jesus will do when he returns to the earth, which will be unknown to the world at large, will be to judge his household, the Ecclesia. For this purpose, the dead are raised, and together with the saints still living at that time are gathered to Sinai. And following this judgment, the faithful are formed into the armies of Yahweh. It is then after Christ has returned to the earth, and while the judgment of the household is in progress, that the Gogian host is preparing and finally moves to attack Israel. And so we'll go back to Zechariah chapter 14, first of all, to which our brother David referred towards the end of his remarks, a chapter which we believe is contemporary with Ezekiel 38, where we read in the first verse, "Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, And I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And then Christ and the saints move up from Sinai against the enemies of Israel. Verse 3. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem, on the east, and the Mount of the Olives shall cleave in the midst toward the east and toward the west. And then at the end of verse 5, and Yahweh my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. So the saints who have been judged faithful in Sinai will be with Christ at that time when he comes against the forces against Jerusalem. And so from this, brethren and sisters, it is evident that we, as members of that household, shall see the final preparation of this confederacy from Sinai. At the present time, we see just the beginnings of the formation of this confederacy. And this means, as Brother David stressed, that we could be taken to judgment at any time. So how careful we need to be then to see that each one of us personally are prepared for this time of judgment. That is indeed the purpose, is it not, of the study of prophecy. Not that we may be very clever and know things that are going to happen in advance. It is that we may be prepared when we go to the judgment seat of Christ. Well, let's then turn to Ezekiel 38 and examine this confederacy, this Gogian confederacy, in a little detail. Ezekiel 38 and the first verse. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Now, as we know, that title, Son of Man, is frequently used throughout the prophecy of Ezekiel in reference to the prophet himself. But it is also a title of the Lord Jesus Christ. It speaks of Ezekiel typically of Jesus. And here it is spoken prophetically of him setting his face against this confederacy. And that Hebrew word which is there rendered against means more than simply to be in opposition to. It means to move against. It is indicative then that of Christ first working amongst the nations that this confederacy may be formed, and then together with the saints actually moving against them in power, as described at the end of this chapter and in chapter 39. Now principally he comes against a specific person, a person who is here styled Gog. And so the first question which we need to address ourselves to is, who is Gog? Apart from these two chapters, 38 and 39, and the 20th chapter of Revelation, the name Gog only occurs in one other place in Scripture, in the first book of Chronicles, chapter 5. It's nothing to do with our subject because it is the name of a descendant of Reuben of whom we know nothing at all. Now as to the meaning of the name, Strong simply says it is of uncertain derivation. Decenius even offers no meaning. But Young gives its meaning as high. And Brother Mansfield in his book on these chapters of Ezekiel makes a quotation from the English and Hebrew Bible Students Concordance saying it means the roof. Well, Haman Gog in chapter 39 is the multitude on the roof. And of course that reminds us of the incident in the book of Judges with the Philistines on the roof of the building where they were destroyed by Samson. Which is of course typical, is it not? Again, of this events at the time of the end. It's not unreasonable then to interpret this name Gog as the one on the top. And indeed he appears in this chapter as the leader of this huge confederacy of nations which is coming against Yahweh's people and Yahweh's land. But if we look into the pages of history, we believe, find two historical personages which illustrate the role to be played by this Gog of the latter days. Now, the first lived about 50 to 100 years before the days of Ezekiel, and may indeed be the background to its use in this prophecy. This is a person whose name is referred to by Ashurbanipal, the king of Assyria, as Gugu. He belonged originally to the royal bodyguard of the king of Lydia and was the king's confidant. But in process of time, he rose up against that king and murdered him, and he took the throne himself. And under this Gugu, the kingdom of Lydia arose to some prominence in Asia Minor, and indeed entered into a treaty of peace with Assyria. Among his conquests were several cities of a people called the Cimmerians, who it is believed were descendants of Gomer, very likely the same people referred to by Brother Thomas as the Galatae, who gave their name to Galatia, which was indeed within Gugu's kingdom. Now, the important point which we wish to stress in connection with this person is that he was not the legitimate hereditary ruler of Lydia, but a usurper who obtained power over that territory by means of a revolution. Now, in Help Us Israel, Brother Thomas brings before us a further historical character whose name actually was Gog. And this person was the chief of the palace in the court of Sigebert, king of Austrasia. And this was the region of the Rhineland extending southward into France, the area to which the Galatae, or the Gauls, eventually migrated. And this person held the reins of government, although he was not himself a ruler. So both of these historical personages then have in common the fact that they were not part of the royal house, the hereditary rulers of the nation, but who nevertheless rose to the highest position of the government of those nations. When we turn our minds to the world in which we live today, consider the various world rulers, we do indeed find such a power, do we not, in the highest office of the USSR. Now, Brother Thomas interpreted Gog as a reference, because of the territories over which he ruled, to the one who styled himself the autocrat of all the Russias, the Tsar of Russia in that time. But 74 years ago, the Tsar was deposed. A revolution took place in Russia, and a republican government established, which claimed to be democratic, following on the slogans on the bottom of this chart of liberty, equality, and fraternity. During the last 12 months, the current president of that area, President Gorbachev, has persuaded the Supreme Soviet to grant him far-reaching powers, which means that he can, if he chooses, rule by his own personal edict, an autocrat of all the Russias indeed. In fact, the office of the President of the Soviet Union today possesses greater legal powers than at any other time since the revolution. Of course, Stalin wielded such power, but he did not in fact possess it legally. It was purely because of his force of personality that he obtained such power and was able to wield his power over his contemporaries. But now, by decree of the Supreme Soviet, that power vests in the office of the president, irrespective of the personality of the person holding that office. As we said, he is indeed an autocrat of all the Russians, should he see fit to exercise the power. Now again, until 12 months or so ago, Gorbachev has impressed the nations of the world as being of a different character from previous Soviet leaders. One who has the good of the Russian people and world peace at heart, not his own personal ambition. But recent events in Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Moldavia and some of the other republics have rather tended to tarnish that image. But even if he himself does not have the character we would expect of Gog, his own personal position is far from secure. He could be succeeded at any time by a far more ruthless character. And such a person, because of the office he holds, would simply take over those immense powers which have been granted, which we say, not to Gorbachev personally, but to the president as an office. So certainly then, in the office of the Soviet president, we have potentially at least one who fits the biblical title of Gog. And because he lacks a royal pedigree, he fits the title far more than did the Tsar. But what then of the territories which he controls? Are they consistent with that of the president of the Soviet Union being Gog? On the map that I left, we see some of these nations actually put in their position, which we will refer. Now, the first we see is the land of Magog. Now, Magog is mentioned in Genesis chapter 10 as one of the sons of Japhet, as are also Meshech, Tubal, Gomer, and Togarmah. Josephus identifies his descendants with the Scythians, who, according to Herodotus, spread from the river Don westward along the banks of the Danube. And so they would thus have travelled through the territories which today we know as Romania, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Austria and Germany. Another ancient historian, one Diodorus Siculus, traces the Scythians much further into Europe, even to the shores of the Baltic. Thus, the land of Magog covers all of Central Europe, including Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary and Romania, and possibly also covering Ukraine, White Russia, and those three small states which the world has forgotten about for nearly 50 years, Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia. Those three to the north of Poland on that chart. Indeed, then Magog covers most of what we know as Roman Catholic Europe. But we may ask, why is it styled the land of Magog? The other territories don't receive that title. The Hebrew word for land is Eretz. It comes six times later in this chapter in the relation to the land of Israel, as Brother David has shown us, styled by Yahweh, my land. So we have, then, a land in opposition to Yahweh's land. And Catholic Europe has a long history of opposition to Yahweh's land. It is a land where there has always been persecution of the Jews. This has been on the grounds that they were the people who crucified the second person of the Catholic Trinity. One of the worst persecutions against Jews, of course, occurred 50 years ago in Hitler's Germany, covering as it did Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Ukraine and so on, as much of those territories which we have mentioned. And although the present German government has officially renounced this policy, there is still much anti-Semitic feeling in that territory today. In the Middle Ages, of course, it was Catholic Europe that organised the Crusades against the land of Israel. Now, this was officially with the objective of freeing the land from Islam. But the prime purpose was, in fact, to gain it for the papacy. And indeed, they did establish a Catholic kingdom of Jerusalem for something like 100 years. And during that period, the people of Israel were no more welcome there than were the followers of Muhammad. So there then we have one part of the Confederacy. Then we move on to what is rendered in the Authorized Version the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. But the word chief is Rosh. And it is generally agreed that that should be rendered as a proper name. The prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. Many historians, including Gibbon, identify this name Rosh as the ancient form of Russia, which of course it very clearly resembles. Moreover, that word Rosh is indeed sometimes in scripture rendered poison. And it is from Russia that the poisonous philosophy of communism has arisen. Now, Meshech and Tubal, further sons of Japhet, moved north after the confusion of tongues at Babel, and their names today are seen in Muscovy or Moscow, again that's shown on the map, and Tobolsky, one of the chief cities of Siberia. So Gog then is prince of Russia, Moscow and Siberia, covering the greater part of the Soviet Union. The Hebrew word translated prince is Nasi, and it means simply an exalted one. And it is not a word which necessarily implies one of royal blood, as we tend to use the word prince today. So again then, it fits the Soviet president, Gog, the exalted one of Russia, Moscow and Siberia. So as we said at the beginning, Brother Thomas was more right than he realised. He identified Gog with the autocrat of all the Russias because he controlled the same territory. But in his days, that office was held by the Tsar, one of the ancient royal families of Europe. But the present autocrat, having arisen as the result of a revolution, having no hereditary blood to support his claims, is a far more accurate identification with the historical examples of Gog. But we notice that he isn't styled the Prince of Magog. And so clearly, he does not actually rule over Magog, but they have accepted him as their military leader in this confederacy. The recent unification of Germany is a step in this direction, as is the coming together of the Pope and the Soviet leader, which we saw not much more than 12 months ago. But let us continue in our chapter, Ezekiel 38 and verse 3. And say, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. So we see that Gog is not in fact, although he believes he is not in control of his actions. We see that circumstances arise which cause him to act in a way which is contrary to the way in which he would wish to act. This again is consistent with what we have seen in Soviet policy over the last half century. They have sought to intervene, as Brother David has told us, many times in the affairs of the Middle East, but always at arm's length. They've done this by sending military advisers, by supplying the countries with huge amounts of armaments. And in the various conflicts between Israel and the Arab states, they have never sought to intervene openly. It's very significant that in the recent Gulf crisis, they very carefully stayed on the sidelines. The present Soviet government, beset as they are with numerous internal problems with their economy in ruins, certainly has no wish to become directly involved militarily in the region. And so, in the recent crisis, they tried to intervene diplomatically, did they not? They tried to preserve the Iraqi military strength by persuading them to come to peace at an early stage before their army was destroyed. They failed in this. No doubt they are still, in fact, so working in order to retain a strong political influence in Iraq, in whatever state it is reorganized. Nevertheless, circumstances will arise in which Russia, whether she desires to do so or whether she does not, is forced to commit her armed forces to the area, as the last half of that fourth verse very clearly informs us, a huge army descending on the land. Now, all these forces comprise what is described in that verse as a great company. That's an interesting word. It's from the Hebrew word kahal, which is the equivalent of the Greek word ecclesia. It means a people called out and gathered together for a purpose. If we just go to the third chapter of Joel's prophecy, we in fact read of this calling out. Joel chapter 3 and verse 9. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. The Hebrew word, which is translated prepare, is the Hebrew word kadash, which means pronounce clean. It comes from the same root as kodesh, which means holy. And so the nations then are called to a holy war. Now, we've heard a lot of this phrase lately on the lips of Saddam Hussein, calling the Arabs against Israel in a holy war. Of course, he didn't succeed. He'd begun on the wrong foot by invading a fellow Arab state and threatening another one, Saudi Arabia. And so he started by setting Muslim against Muslim. So he couldn't succeed in his call for a holy war. Nevertheless, from Joel chapter 3, it does appear to be a holy war which will eventually bring this confederacy against Israel. But not a holy war consisting of a united Arab world against Israel. For this confederacy, as we have seen so far, is predominantly made up of the nations of Christendom, Catholic Europe, together with Eastern Orthodox Russia. Atheism is no longer the state philosophy. The church is again coming into prominence in Soviet Russia. But Russia also, of course, has a very considerable Muslim population in the parts bordering Iran or Persia. And we continue in Ezekiel 38 to read of other nations in this confederacy, most of which are indeed Muslim powers. Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 5. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Tagamah of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people with thee. Persia, of course, we know, modern Iran. In this connection, it's worth quoting the words of Brother Percy Mansfield in his book Ezekiel's Prophecies of the Restoration, which he wrote about 30 years ago. And at that time, Brother Mansfield wrote, today, Persia is pro-West, but circumstances or conquest will cause it to come under the domination of Russia. And you recall how suddenly the pro-Western Shah was deposed just over 10 years ago, and the Ayatollah Khomeini took power. And since then, Iran, whilst not being pro-Russian, has certainly been very anti-Western. One of the most interesting features of the recent war was their cooperation with Russia in efforts to save Iraq from military defeat. As for Ethiopia and Libya, here we have two other nations. Ethiopia, partly Muslim, partly a very certain type of so-called Christianity, and the other one, wholly Muslim, in this confederacy, Libya. Now, if there is one thing that could unite the papacy, Eastern Orthodoxy, and a considerable part of Islam together, it is hatred of Israel. But this confederacy will not include all of Islam. Islam will be divided, as we shall see. Gomer refers to the Galatae, or Gaul, to whom we have already referred. They migrated to the west and settled in France, a further part of Catholic Europe. So we see a confederacy covering the whole of mainland Europe, Gorbachev's declared aim of a Europe united from the Urals to the Atlantic, together, indeed, with much of Western Asia. And the other nation mentioned is Tagama. He was a son of Gomer, but he didn't migrate west with his father, but he remained, as Ezekiel says, of the north quarters. Initially, they settled in Turkestan, which is the predominantly Islam area of Soviet Union, a little bit to the east of that map. But many of them then migrated from there into Armenia, Georgia, and Asia Minor, giving that area its modern name of Turkey. So with this in mind, let us now turn to Daniel chapter 11, where we are referred to the king of the north. Originally, in this chapter, this was one of the divisions of Alexander's empire, covering an area which we today know as eastern Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, together with that southern part of Asiatic Russia, Turkestan, very roughly. The end of this chapter also takes us to the time of the end, verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now, him, we believe, is the ruler in Constantinople or Istanbul. A push against him by the king of the south, we believe, is largely in the past. But the king of the north is to come against him, the ruler of modern Turkey, with military force, including many ships. This has only become possible, of course, in the last 40 years or so. But as we read on, we see the differing allegiance of many of the Muslim nations. Verse 41. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. So he invades the glorious land, that is the land of Israel, the land which Yahweh referred to as my land. But Edom, Moab and Ammon, they escape. And those territories, of course, if we plot them on a modern map, comprise modern Jordan. So Jordan is not going to be involved in the affairs of Daniel chapter 11. They escape. But then, on the other hand, Egypt, it says at the end of verse 42, Egypt shall not escape. So Egypt will be conquered. So there we have Go coming against Libya, against Egypt. But then it says that Libya and Ethiopia, we saw mentioned in Ezekiel 38, they will be at his steps, that is, they will be allied to him. So this chapter then gives us a three-way division of Muslim nations. First of all, we have those with Gog: Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, Turkey. And very likely, because they were part of the territory of the ancient king of the north, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and Pakistan. Wouldn't be dogmatic on that point, but they were certainly part of the ancient king of the north. So together with the so-called Christian countries of Europe, we have those Muslim powers. But then the second division was Edom, Moab and the children of Ammon, which is, we said, Jordan, and that's left alone. It isn't completely left alone, as further addresses today will show. But from the point of view of Daniel 11, that appears to be neutral. But then on the other hand, Gog is against Egypt. And also, as we believe later addresses will show, Saudi Arabia and other territories will be against this Gogian confederacy. So this holy war then doesn't unite all the Arabs, it divides them. And that, of course, is not surprising. Because in the Muslim world as we see it today, there are some very deep-seated divisions, very strong religious differences between the Sunnis and the Shiites. Shiites in Iran and southern part of Iraq. Saddam Hussein, as we know, is a Sunni, as together are some of the in Syria, we understand. There is this very deep division, religious division, amongst the Muslim people. They are not by any means united in religion, nor in their intentions in respect of the world. And these differences will be exacerbated, will they not, when the Russian army invades Turkey, because that is also a Muslim power. So we have the Soviet Union, much of which is Muslim, invading another Muslim power, Turkey, and that will set up as many divisions amongst those nations as did the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. But Daniel then continues to show how this confederacy will not succeed. Verse 44. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Meanwhile, in Ezekiel 38, we continue to read more detail. Ezekiel 38 and verse 7. Be thou prepared, and prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. Now that's a different word which is from that which is translated prepared in Joel chapter 3. Here it is the Hebrew word kun, which means to be erect, set up, established. And the word guard is from Mishmar, meaning to hedge about as by thorns. And that is a word which suggests military defence, does it not? And yet the word assembled is from Kahal, which we saw in verse 4, meaning ecclesia. So Gog is exhorted to form a military defence around the company he has assembled for these warlike purposes. But it is Yahweh, we notice, who is calling upon Gog to prepare. And so it comes in the nature of a challenge. Gog thinks that he has prepared an invincible offensive army. So all he's got to do is walk down into Israel and that'll be the end of it. He's probably not very interested in a defensive strategy. But Yahweh, of course, knows that it is defense of which he will be in the greatest need in those days, because there is a power coming against him which is indeed invincible, one against which he cannot stand. Verse 8. After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, and is gathered out of many people, against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith Adonai Yahweh. It shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods that dwell in the midst of the land. So this great confederacy of Gog then is to come against that land of Israel like a storm, because of the evil thought which will come into Gog's mind. There is in this verse a strong hint also of their route of attack. In verse 11 he says, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. And to go up, scripturally speaking, means to go in a northward direction. Now we might at first think this is the wrong way round for someone coming from the north. But it is of course consistent with what we saw in Daniel 11 when we read of the king of the north having first conquered Egypt and then hearing tidings out of the east and the north, resulting in his going forth with great fury to destroy and then planting the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. So it seems then that his first move after subjugating Turkey will be against Egypt, and then to move up to Israel in order to take a spoil and a prey. But at that point he receives a challenge, and that, brethren and sisters, is the subject of the next address.